This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Julianne Scott Pollack has taken on a daunting academic challenge. She studies what it's like to be in someone else's body. She wants to know how that body contributes to the person's identity. And while these questions are at the center of her scholarship, for Julianne, it's more than academic. It's a part of her life. Julianne is a disabled woman, and she knows that people have made assumptions about her body her whole life. Julianne Scott Pollack is an associate professor of communication studies at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, and the director of the UNCW Performance Studies. Julianne, welcome to the State of Things.
Well, thanks for having me.
Talk a little bit about your work, because I know a big part of your work is performance ethnography. What is that?
It is. Well, performance ethnography is the commitment to creating a product for consumption outside of academia that helps audiences understand what it means to be a member of a different cultural group. So for my performance ethnographic work, I do both in-depth, open-ended interviews, as well as participant observation, which is going into a culture and watching that culture and becoming a part of that culture for some time. And so what I do with, I do traditional articles, and I've written a book. But on top of that, what I also do is create something that anyone can access based on the stories of the people who I met. The most profound pieces, the ones that people really resonate with as I talk about my research, I convert those interviews and those observations into either short films. Sometimes those are pedagogical. They'll feature college students as part of a course, as well as one-woman shows that are live performances in which I will embody the story of one of my participants or several of my participants.
And in a way, we're using performance in two slightly different ways. You're talking about a performance, a theatrical performance that might be the product, but the performance of one's cultural identity is what kind of we do every day.
Oh, very much so. Yeah. And that's really the juxtaposition of the work that I do. I study the performance of daily life. And this idea is how we become who we are is through interacting with other people. And other people respond to our bodies, we respond to theirs in this cultural context. And through those cues, we keep becoming who we are. And that idea is, as you're watching me, I'm watching you, we're reading each other's expressions, we are also listening to one another and incorporating these understandings into who we are as individuals, as well as how we understand culture. So it's an ongoing production in this way.
So we grow up absorbing a culture, right, inculcation. We take the cues, a little more of this, Frank, a little less of that. We got a disapproving look when I acted in such a way. And that's how we then pass on these cultural norms, right? So that's the transmission of these things. And we don't think about it as culture. It's how we grow up. Now the ethnographer's job, right, is to tell us about other people, about people who didn't grow up next door to us. And, of course, the trick has always been how you do that and not exoticize, not treat it as something totally alien, and yet in some way, you know, be faithful to the representation of what you're doing. You come at this in a way that is not necessarily traditional.
No, I'm a critical ethnographer, which means in so many ways we've always thought of ethnography as something to try to be as emotionally detached so that you can be as objective as you can possibly be. I'm not detached, and I am also not seeking to be objective. I'm seeking to be empathetic and to be an advocate. So in that way, I want others to understand the story and lived experience of the people I'm conducting research with, and I want them to understand it from the perspective of that person that shared their story and their cultural space with me. So I'm looking in that way to advocate for a more open society, a more accepting society. For an example, when I did in-depth interviews and spent time with bulimic women who self-identified as bulimic, I wanted to make sure the story that was told was a story they wanted to tell, and that I wasn't diagnosing and that I wasn't exoticizing them, that I was allowing people to understand binging and purging is an ingrained part of our culture that has manifested in some women and some men becoming bulimic. So there's this idea of moving away from the medical model of stigmatized bodies, which is what I tend to study, into an understanding what it's like to live in that body in this culture.
So the virtue, of course, in this kind of research is a much more intimate understanding and a subjective point of view that the person who's living this experience gets to tell their story. The warning might be, and the danger might be, is that, you know, we all like to shade our own stories a little bit. And the objective observer, the detective from the outside, might notice things that the subject doesn't want to talk about.
Oh, and that's true. And I think that can always be a part of the study and a part of the performance, because my body isn't erased. My body's still there. I'm the researcher doing this work. And I chose which stories to tell. I chose the transitions between those stories. I chose the introduction and the conclusion. So having that there, my lens is there. It just hasn't overtaken their stories.
Right. And of course, with the so-called objective observers, and of course, this was the stuff that really characterized the all academic study, at least up until the first half of the 20th century, there's a bit of a conceit here that somehow we can do this, that you're going to somehow be objective, but you bring to every study your own cultural expectations and norms, even if you try to study them and filter, right?
And I think that is the difference between a critical ethnographer who will tell you, of course I have subjectivities. Of course I have biases. Of course I have experiences that motivated me to want to learn more about this. And I'm not going to try to detach myself from those. I'm going to have reflexivity, which means I'm going to keep wrestling and reexamining and being open about that struggle with my reader and with my audience. And so I think that's the difference of trying to have that ongoing conversation. And that goes back to, we're making meaning, we're making identity, we're struggling, and things are never finished. There's always chances for reinterpretation.
Now, you have cerebral palsy. How does this affect your, how did it influence your decision to do this kind of research? And to what extent what part does it play in the way you do your research?
Sure. Well, I was diagnosed with cerebral palsy at 18 months old, and I have an atypical gait. That gait was very atypical for the first 13 or so years of my life, and that I was up on my toes, my feet faced each other. Because of that, in order to walk, I had to hunch my back a little bit in order to have leverage to be able to move. And that attracted stares to my body. People wanted to understand that body. In a lot of ways, how they want to understand it was to make sure it wasn't contagious, that it wasn't going to happen to them. And that idea of watching me, I could never really forget about my body, not only because I was having some difficulty moving through space and having the pain of what cerebral palsy does is my brain sends messages to my body to tense. So whenever it tells me to walk, it would be the same movement your leg would do if someone stuck you with a pin unexpectedly. So there is this sort of sharp, irregular gait that can cause tense muscles and pain. But I noticed that even when I wasn't particularly in pain, people were staring. People were watching. There was this cultural gaze that I was always navigating that came with assumptions. People assuming my life was going to be cut short, that I was going to eventually not be able to walk at all. You know, people would spin these stories of, oh, the tragedy of such a young life cut. Like, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm mortal just like you are. I'm not going to die sooner. And so there's all this idea, well, maybe I will, but it won't be because of cerebral palsy. So there is this idea that because people watched my body so closely, I became fascinated with how people read bodies. And I started wondering, well, how am I reading someone else's body? What assumptions am I making about your body based on the cultural cues I get and the categories I'm putting you in? So I think of, I always thought of disabled people in some ways. And in my most recent study, I've been thinking about more and more as hyper-embodied, and that I'm so aware of my mortal body and how my mortal aging body is impacting my identity and how I'm reading other people's bodies. So there is almost this look at the body that I have because my own body stands out. That makes me want to know more about other people's experiences.
Well, and it also means that you have to be very much aware of what the norms are and what the expectations are, and then how you meet or don't meet those norms and expectations. I mean, that's an extra layer of understanding and consciousness, right, to see how you do or do not fit and then be aware. When did you first notice, for instance, the assumptions? Obviously, the gaze was something you'd pick up on very early, but then when did you start noticing these other assumptions that people made after they looked at you?
Well, it was very early on. I remember people saying, when I was just a little child, I remember people saying to my mother, "I'm so sorry." Thinking, sorry for what? I am fantastic. What would you be sorry about? And I remember at 4 years old, I had to get my legs operated on, and people being like, "Oh, I'm so sorry. How is she? Oh, this isn't fixing it. That's so sad," because it was a series of operations and cerebral palsy can't be fixed. So there was this real idea that there was assumptions surrounding my body. People also assumed that I had learning disabilities, that I was going to struggle academically, which I did not. There was people who, again, assumed it was progressive and was going to end in a very tragic way, which cerebral palsy does not. And then that goes on through my life. There was people I remember dating boys in high school and college and their mothers wanting to know if I was fertile or not, which was not a question my friends that did not have atypical bodies were getting.
We'll talk about some more of the questions that Julianne Scott Pollack got throughout her career. She's an associate professor in communications at UNC Wilmington. And our conversation continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Julianne Scott Pollack is an associate professor of communication studies at UNC Wilmington. She studies what it's like to live in bodies that make culture uncomfortable. She has firsthand experience. She is a disabled woman. We talked about that, cerebral palsy, your diagnosis at a very early age and the impact that it had on you. Also, you talked about the fact that you were very aware of that other people were looking at you. How was your family reacting to this and the attention that you got?
Well, in so many ways, I have a very loving, connected family that also is very aware of how other people are seeing and reading our family. And in that way, I was getting a lot of negative attention that meant those around me, my loved ones, were wondering what my life was going to be like. And there was a lot of my mother focusing in some ways of, well, there's going to be a lot of operations. It's going to keep getting better and better. I had siblings who in my family were a big Italian family where people get married and have lots of babies. And there was a question, was my body going to be so rejected that wouldn't be something that happened for me? I remember my sister coming home from high school. She's 8 years older than me. And saying to my mother, I asked some of the boys at school if they would ever date someone who had a limp. And they said they would. So maybe Julie will be able to have boyfriends. And I remember being there as a 10-year-old and thinking, well, I'd never thought of that. Maybe I would never have a boyfriend. I hadn't really thought about boyfriends much at all. But it made me aware at that time how my family was worried, how the cultural gaze, the stigma that comes from living in a disabled body, was going to give me a life that did not have the priorities that they valued that made their own lives meaningful.
How did you interact with other kids in the neighborhood?
Well, in the neighborhood, I mean, it was a really small town. So that neighborhood in so many ways, since there's the kids next door and the kids across the street, nobody else has any other options. So there was a closeness that people just got used to my body and knew what I could do and what I couldn't. And I was pretty fast for someone whose feet were facing each other. I could play pretty well. I was a good swimmer. So I had a great childhood in that way. Now, if you expand more to the public school setting where people didn't know me, there was some rejecting of my body, and that I clearly was not going to be in the cool group of kids because I didn't meet that aesthetic. And so there's a little bit of the some children who did still want to play with me because I was very normal to them in other ways. We shared interests. And then there was others who felt bad for me. And I think in some ways wanted to demonstrate how nice they could be to this disabled person, which was incredibly awkward. So it kind of just depended on finding that niche and finding that very small group of friends who were at ease with the body I was in.
And you also had an interest in theater.
Oh, very much so, from a very young age.
So talk about that, because I know you love being on stage, and you thought when they were going to do the miracle worker, here it is, the part I was made for.
Yes, yeah. I was so excited because I realized I'm very short if, compared to the other kids at high school. I ended up skipping a grade. I was there a year early. I was just a small kid. And so I always kind of knew that I was going to get the child part or sometimes a very old person part, which tended to not be the lead. And then my senior year, we were doing the miracle worker. And I was like, I can definitely play Helen Keller. She can walk a little funny. We should be fine. And my audition was awesome. And I found out after I didn't get the part from the director, he knew it was some really physical scenes. And knowing I had cerebral palsy, he just wasn't confident I would be able to physically handle the role. And I suddenly realized, I'm like, oh my gosh, I can't play the disabled character, really? And it was stunning for me in a way that those assumptions that and he never asked right. that those really was part of people's again reading and trying to understand and deciding the ability, the endurance of my body.
Well, how did you take that at the time? Because I can think of two big ways. One way is to sort of retract and say, I guess that's it. Or the other way is to become angry and say, I'll show them.
Well, and I had more of a, once the shock wore off, and that took a little while, once the shock and the grieving wore off, the direction I went is, well, what ways can my body be on stage? Because I know I'm a good storyteller. I've got a lot of presence. People tell me all the time how much presence and how well-spoken I am and how well I embody other characters. What can I do? And I think that's why during college, I was in the Boston area, I started doing a lot of more of the non-mainstream theater. Mm-hmm. I started doing street theater and reenacting the Salem witch trials. I started being in a traveling theater troupe that did chamber theater, of doing an entire show that was taking place in only 6 feet. And I started doing those kinds of work and realized that there was this other side of theater, especially because I was a strong creative writer. I was a creative writing major. I was a double major in that way. And I said, there is a place here for me to do what I do.
And what was it like for you? I mean, what kinds of other thoughts were you? I mean, every actor obviously thinks about embodying another character. That's what you do. But I wonder what other thoughts you were having because of all these other experiences about this job of inhabiting another body, feeling what it's like to live in that body.
What I often would think about is there a way for this character to emerge from the body I'm in? Is there a way for me to get at who this character is through a body that is perhaps not how a director or audience is envisioning this character? And the answer was yes, quite a few times.
But that means you really have to think about other aspects, other characteristics of this character, right? Other than what they look like or what they've been described by the writer.
Very much so. It's like, can I really get the emotional needs and motivations of this character in such a strong way that the director says, I understand this character at a level so much more deeply than the other people auditioning that will work around the atypical walk. And so that happens sometimes, not a lot, but it happened sometimes and showed me the power of being able to emotionally connect in a way that resonated with a director and audience of who this character was.
So all of this, you're really getting much more deeply into theater. Then you go to college and you decide you want to be a lawyer.
I did.
Tell us about that decision.
Well, while I was at college, I realized I was a persuasive storyteller. People listened to me a lot, that I was able to create a compelling argument on my feet, and my ability to tell stories really well to help people empathize and visualize a space seemed as though it might lend itself to that particular profession. Mm-hmm. And so I thought about becoming a lawyer, and I studied abroad for a semester in Italy and really was thinking about myself. And I'm like, I think this is the direction I'm going. And so I came back, and an English professor who was also the director of the theater troupe that I was a part of said to me, and he was always a very blunt person, he said to me, Scott, law is going to break your heart. He says, you care so deeply about others honoring the experience of people. You have this deep commitment to social justice, which wasn't a term I even knew at that time. He said that you're going to get fed up with law. You're going to get upset. You're not going to be able to handle when the wrong person wins. And the wrong person wins all the time in law. He says, it's just not where you belong. He goes, you're an artist. You're a storyteller. You're going to be an activist. I can feel it. He says, you need to find another avenue, which is when he told me about performance ethnography. He goes, you excel at creative nonfiction. You excel at empathy. You excel at personal performance on stage. He said, this is where you belong. You belong in performance studies with a narrative and ethnography focus.
Had you even heard of that before?
I'd never heard of it. He gave me an article to read that was written by who would become my future advisor. And I set off. And she happened to be working in the University of Maine, which is where the state I grew up in. Mm-hmm. So I got to, in some ways, go back to my home state. And I worked with her for 8 years, and he was right. Him pushing me in that direction, I was thrown off at first because I was expecting him to say, yes, I'll write the letter when you need it. Right. That was how I thought that conversation was going to go. But he knew me well, and I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be.
I want to talk more about that and what you're doing now, but let's talk about the social justice piece. You say that's a phrase that you hadn't really used before. What was it that you were doing that led this instructor to think that social justice was deep in your heart?
Well, he had traveled a lot with me because we were in a traveling theater troupe, so he had seen me on the road. And how he referred to me was that I was a radical inclusionist, that I really wanted to understand everyone in the troupe, the people. We had to stay in other people's houses, and when we would go to these different towns and countries, we would stay with the local people. And how I always seemed to want to understand why people were acting the way they were. Even the most difficult people in the troupe, he says, you always care so deeply of knowing where they're from, if they've been ostracized, if they've been stigmatized, is there a way to find connection? He says, you have this need to stand up and be with people on the margins. And he says, and I said, well, no, I'm just, you know, trying to make sure everyone feels included. He goes, that's going to get broader than interpersonal the older you get. He says, this is going to move from you wanting to be just inclusive to those around you to you wanting culture to be more this way. He says, you just haven't gotten there quite yet.
Well, did you, and when did you notice that it's not just one-on-one, but there are some whole systems that keep people in these positions and keep other people sort of at their throats?
Well, I think I learned that mostly through a course he told me to take. He said, you need to take rhetorical criticism. And that's where I started to have the language to describe these power dynamics that I was seeing, these power dynamics that were coming at my own body, that was wanting people to question, to move me to the side of society, assuming I was incapable or lacking in some way before they really even knew me, simply because there was all kinds of stigma written upon a body that moved like mine. Although, of course, that got less as I got older, because it's true the operations changed things in some ways, but those memories stayed clear, I think, in so many ways.
Let's talk a little bit about that for a moment, and the fact that that cerebral palsy is not a progressive disease, as many people might assume, and that the surgery really did help you over time, although it was certainly taxing. Talk about your ordeal over the years, but the impact that the surgery has had.
Oh, sure. Well, my surgery started at 4 and ended at 24. And the one that was really transformative is around 12 or 13, they sawed my femur bones in half, rotated them 30 degrees, and nailed them back together again. And with the lengthening of all my muscles, while now I walked a bit flat-footed and a bit stiff, people no longer immediately saw it as some sort of deformity that was congenital or progressive or a disease in some way. People now thought, oh, it looks like she hurt her ankle. It looks like she hurt her leg. Because I had been doing different kinds of physical therapy since I was 4, I had tremendous muscle definition. It was very thin. So people would assume that I was an athlete that had been hurt. A lot of people said, oh, you have the body of a dancer, would be told to me a lot early on in college. They'd say, oh, you have a body of a dancer. Do you dance? And I'd be like, well, no, with cerebral palsy, that's not something that I would never be a competitive dancer. That's not my medium. But there was this idea of reading my body as perhaps athletic and injured as opposed to having a progressive degree.
So much of our self-image and so much of the story that we tell ourselves is based on our sense of our body and how we think other people are perceiving our body, which is more or less stable throughout our lives. And yours has changed, as you say, as a result of surgeries, one in particular that changed things dramatically. What does that do to you and your sense of yourself?
Well, it can be overwhelming at times. And I think when I crossed that threshold to suddenly being possibly aesthetically pleasing to many people and having that experience of no longer having to navigate that initial rejection, revulsion that people would have to my body in the beginning, pity. All those things weren't there anymore. And while it was freeing, because it had been reiterated into my body so much, so long, for over a decade, that is how people responded to me. So it's still easy for me to reach back and feel that. I haven't been able to really forget it, because we talk about sometimes being able to forget it. And well, once you overcome those sorts of things that I've had one person who told me, it's kind of like a phenomenological amnesia that you can just, because you're not experiencing that phenomenon anymore, you don't care. It wasn't that way for me. Instead, every time I saw someone experiencing marginalization and stigma, the ability to feel how that must feel was so overpowering for me, it came right back. I had that embodied knowledge of what it was like to be on the margin, even if I had been invited into the center.
It's fascinating to think about what that would mean for you looking back and trying to recall and keep in mind that experience as you move forward. But then there's the other side of that, which is this experience we have, and I think it's also associated with eating disorders and other disorders that have to do with body image. If you're reinforced in a particular form, so if you lose a few pounds and you're reinforced in this, it can lead to compulsive behavior as well. Oh my goodness, this is really nice. More of that. Did any of that happen to you?
Well, in some ways it did. I think I became, for a little while, I go into this a little bit in my book, this idea of wanting to really eat very well. To the point where I went to a vegan diet, and then it was a vegan organic diet, and I was exercising so much and I was doing so much flexibility work of I'm going to really take care of this body I have and also make it be less intrusive, more accepted, all of these things that I hoped, because I was still having chronic pain from muscle contraction. So I was still constantly aware of my body's need for maintaining. So I think in some ways I became obsessed for a while. And I think the reason how I moved beyond that and stopped being so focused on my own body was this idea of listening to the stories of other bodies. As I got into graduate school, and I think there was no accident that I was interested in eating disorders first. Those were the first stories I wanted to listen to. Because while I'd never had bulimia, I had this fixation on my body. And so it made sense to me to want to hear those stories. And that is how I was able in so many ways to move from my own body. Not that I don't still think about it all the time. I think that's why a lot of my work has my own positioning in it as well as I interact with others, I did start thinking more about, well, how am I looking at other bodies like they're looking at mine? And that interest in other people meant that I could look beyond myself more.
One of the other people you got interested in is the man who had become your husband when you were in grad school. Tell us about meeting him.
Sure. Well, I had been at the University of Maine a couple of years. I'm older than Evan Scott Pollock is. And we met at graduate orientation. I was working for the graduate school, helping coordinate the orientation, and he was being oriented. And it was we met, and it was just in passing. I actually don't remember meeting mm-hmm. him because I met, you know, so many people that day. But he remembered me. My shirt was too big because they were out of smalls, and he remembered me wearing a really oversized shirt. And so he kept interested in wanting to know more about what I did because he had heard that she does storytelling. He goes, I know you get a PhD in storytelling. What is that? He's in physics. And so he invited me to go out with him and lots of his friends often. But we actually got together a couple of years later. One of his friends asked me out on a date for Cinco de Mayo, and it was going terribly. As someone who's an interviewer, can talk to almost anyone, this was a really forced conversation. And Evan came in with another one of his friends, and in a desperate attempt to save the evening, I called him over. And so we had a wonderful night, the four of us that night, and he ended up taking me to Bar Harbor with him and a friend the next day and said, would you like to maybe go out again sometime? And I said, sure. And he called 2 hours later and said, would you like to go to a movie?
I was thinking, 2 hours later, but sure, let's go.
And we've been together ever since.
Julianne Scott Pollock, an associate professor of communication studies at UNC Wilmington, studies what it's like to live in a body that makes people within other cultures uncomfortable. We'll continue that conversation and talk more about her work when our show continues. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with Julianne Scott Pollock, who studies bodies that make people uncomfortable. She has had firsthand experience as a disabled woman diagnosed with cerebral palsy. She is an associate professor in communication studies at UNC Wilmington. So let's talk about some of your studies. You talked about bulimia being the first. So what are you looking for? What's going to be the product when you begin these investigations? What are you trying to achieve?
Well, and I think that idea is why sometimes my research can especially make quantitative people uncomfortable, is this idea is what I'm looking for is I want to know about the phenomenon of what it is like to live in this culture in the body you're in. I want to understand what it means to live with bulimia, what that feels like physically, what it feels like emotionally, what it feels like socially, what it means about moving through space. I want to know. So begin your story where you think it begins. End it where you want it to end. I've got questions if you'd like me to ask, but I'd like to hear the story as you tell it. And that's the same thing. I went with self-identified physically disabled professionals. If you identify as physically disabled, if you identify as a professional, tell me your story. I'm the same thing with people who are experiencing memory loss and most recently seizures. And for that reason, stories go in so many different directions. And sometimes I have an entire book chapter or an entire article that I never imagined was coming from this particular study because that was a recurrent theme.
Well, let's talk about those themes. Let's go back to eating disorders. Are there themes that came through and what are they?
Well, the themes that came through was this idea of what I called this performance of unfeminine femininity. And this idea is binging and purging does not have control. It does not have this feeling of self-restraint or delicate femininity that we think about when we think it's not pretty. Mm. Binging and purging in some ways is something we like to keep hidden. It's gross. And in this way, how to say, as I'm pursuing this culturally dominant feminine shape that I want to have in my public performance of self, there is also this hidden performance that I'm using to get there that is deeply rejected by society. And what is the push and pull of this outward and inward performance that in many times are colliding as people become more aware of disordered behavior. So it was fascinating in that way. There was also this master narrative of bulimia and this idea of, and in so many ways we see in this way, well, I want your individual story. Culture is shaping how you're going to tell that story. Mm. And the medical community is shaping how mm-hmm. you're going to tell that story. So in so many ways, they're like, that's right. Okay, so I need something that made me become bulimic. And everyone's looking for that piece of where did it start? And it was my mom or it was my boyfriend or it was the fashion industry. And then moving through the spiral down when they decided to get help or if they hadn't decided to get help, how they were hoping to come out of it, how they were going to cope long term, this deep acceptance of, well, it can never really be healed, you know, about, you know, disordered yeah. people like us. So it was interesting to see that even as people resisted this master narrative and tried to give their own caveats to it.
Well, how do you
cut
through that?
They still talked about it.
Well, sure, because if they've been through enough therapy and if they've had a diagnosis, right, they've seen enough professionals, they're now talking in the same terms, right? Their lexicon is now the medical lexicon and the psychological terminology. And yeah, they begin telling their stories the way they've been told. So how do you break through that without putting words in their mouth?
Well, I don't put words in their mouth for sure. That's so important. And so what I'll keep asking is asking more questions. Mm. Can you tell me more about your relationship with your boyfriend? Can you tell me more about how this continues to impact you right now? Can you give me another story that's happened more recently? Can you tell me more about your mom? Can you tell me more? And in that way, as I give those openings to tell me more, people are like, oh, you're not going to be resistant to me being resistant to that dominant story. And I think at first when someone comes in, they want to tell the story they know as their audience, I perhaps will find most comfortable because I saw it in a Lifetime movie or this is what I've heard they should say. So it takes rapport. It takes time. It takes sometimes multiple conversations for someone to feel comfortable deviating from what culture finds comfortable in their story.
And what we find comfortable and certainly familiar in the story about that, we'll talk about this for one more minute, is that there is a discomfort with your body. There's something in your own mind that makes you feel you're not quite right and not acceptable the way you are. There's something you can do about it to become acceptable. And there's some perhaps image that you have in mind that you're trying to reach. There's a model of form that you're aspiring to. Is that what they're thinking? Is that how they see it?
I think in so many ways we talk about this idea of wanting to have control, wanting to be loved, wanting to be pleasing to other people. And I think what I really make sure that I emphasize is that desire is not limited to bulimic women. That desire in our entire society, how many people say, oh my God, I have one study that compares the binging and purging of food to the binging and purging of credit. during the economic crash and this idea of like, well, I just spent a lot, but I'm not going to do that again. So it's going to be fine. I'm going to get everything under control. And that idea that we have all kinds of like, well, yeah, I did go see that person again that I said I wasn't going to talk to, but I'm not going to do it again. And it's like, so binging and purging is not a bulimic woman's problem. It's a ubiquitous cultural problem.
Let's talk about the other group. One of the other groups that you studied, professionals with disability. What were you asking? How do you begin the interview process there?
Well, right there, my first question is, I'm interested in your story of being a physically disabled professional. Begin where you'd like to begin. And a lot of people did want to focus more on their time in the workplace. But many people said, in order to understand what it means to be a physically disabled professional, I've got to talk to you about what it means to have sex being physically disabled. And I've got to talk to you about what it means to be social physically disabled outside of the workplace. So these stories in so many ways, while I was focused on the workplace for that particular study, the workplace ended up being just one chapter of a 5-chapter study. And in that way, because we talked about gender and sexual identity, we talked about what it's like just to live inside the visceral experience of being disabled. So it ended up being in so many different directions that I believe I would now rename that study of the phenomenon of living through a disabled body. But at the time, I thought it was going to be much more narrow than it was.
Well, what did you learn, and what were some of the big takeaways for you as they began telling you these stories and taking you away from your chapter title?
Well, and so, I think it was interesting because when it came to the workplace, I saw that really because we are so uncomfortable with disabled bodies, especially in the workplace, because what do we tell us people in the workplace? We tell them to tone down the body, right? Workplace clothes don't show too much skin. Mm-hmm. Workplace clothes, workplace bodies don't smell too strong. They don't have too much makeup. They don't have too big of hair. And here is this body that is getting noticed, that is attracting the gaze, that you can't erase like we'd like to when we're having comfortable professional interactions. And so in this way, people would turn these bodies into characters. Now, of all 26 interviews, every body became one of four characters. And either the superhero of, oh my goodness, this person is disabled, but they're better than all of us that are able-bodied. What an inspiration. This idea of super crip in some ways. Mm. And then we had the warrior. And it was like, oh my goodness, can you believe how this person perseveres? And they move through. They're in chronic pain. They're having these surgeries. But here they are pressing on. What an inspiration. And then there's these other bodies that people were saying, oh, isn't it so sad they're going to have to leave because they had so much hope and so much promise, but they're a tragic hero we're going to have to say goodbye to. And then we have the villain. And that's the person who has fallen from grace. This person is not a superhero. They're not a warrior hero. They're seeming in some way to be taking up resources they don't deserve, taking time. They can't do the job the way we want them to do. And instead of leaving, they're staying, which is causing resentment in this space. And so we saw these people all navigating these sort of characters that had been created.
And were these observations, these archetypes, observations that you made, or were they reporting this to you that I feel
like? Well, it was like, as I listened to the stories, yeah. I could feel each of these characters emerging. I could categorize each of the stories in these spaces. There was also this idea of, we always assume that that disabled bodies are going to be asexual, that people aren't going to find them very sexual. But we found that that wasn't actually the case for quite a few bodies. Some said, well, my disabled body in some ways needs more care and more love. And so in some ways, I almost feel like it hyperfeminizes me because it means that men in my life want to take care of me and feel this delicateness about me that they can now be a savior in some ways. So there was almost this hyperfemination that happened. And then some men said, as I deal with this chronic illness, there is this idea of this progressive disease, especially, or this injury. Women are inspired, saying how strong you are, how much I can lean on you, that you are someone who can handle adversity. And so it almost became this more hyper of the strength of their masculinity was enhanced rather than diminished by their disability. So those kinds of things were fascinating to see.
You've also done studies on people with memory disorders, Alzheimer's in particular. Tell us about that.
Sure. Well, that was a very different kind of study. It was something I was compelled to do because the older generation in my both my and my husband's family had dementia and progressed to Alzheimer's very quickly. And I wanted to understand more about memory loss and also about aging. It came in my life where I was no longer a young person, really. I was just an average adult and was starting to think more about aging. And so I went in. I wanted to have these studies, and I ended up going into mostly affluent retirement homes, not because I wanted to study affluent people, but because sometimes the lower income facilities were very reluctant to allow researchers in, where the more affluent says, oh, of course, we've got people that would love to tell their stories. Come in. These are important people that would love to have someone to talk to about how important they were. So they were much more interested in having me come visit. And so I asked people the question, first, now, at this moment, experiencing memory loss, what are the memories that you don't want forgotten? What are those memories? What are the stories you want told? And people took that in a lot of different directions. It was really interesting to see which stories defined people's lives that they wanted reiterated.
Give us an example.
Sure. I had one woman who called me in, and her entire story as a church-going woman her entire life was she wanted to get on tape how She had become an atheist about 20 years ago and never stopped attending church and never stopped being a deep part of that community. But she wanted her children to know that I really think this is all there is. And that's okay that this is all there is. I don't think I'm going to be reunited with your sister who died. I think all we have is here, and that's why you have to make the most of life here. And she went right from being an evangelical Christian in her early 20s to this position in her 80s. And the fact that she said that doesn't mean I don't think religion is good, and I don't think my church can do good things, and my church has progressed, and I'm very excited about their inclusiveness in so many ways that I've helped foster and create. She said, but in the end, I need you to understand that when I say goodbye, that I'm really saying goodbye and that I'm at peace with that. And that was a story that she just wanted them to know, that this is, despite what you might be assuming because you see me go to church every Sunday and I'm so involved in this, I want you to know where I stand and for you to be at ease with that. And I had, I don't know if I have time for one more. Mm-hmm. I had another woman who called me to a room and she said, I have four sons. Between those four sons, I had a stillborn daughter. And she isn't someone I ever talk about because it makes people so sad. Again, uncomfortable bodies, stories of stillbirth are uncomfortable, deeply uncomfortable. She said, but they need to know that she was here. And she went through the fact that she had their father's hair and her father's round face and had her fingers. And all of these things to say, this little girl, she was here, she was connected with you. And you need to remember her because she's part of this family. I'm the only one left who saw her. And she kept saying over and over, but she was here. And so that idea of having a verbal picture of this stillborn sister's face that she had never in so many years shared with them. But in the end, she goes, I now realize she'll disappear with me if you don't remember her.
So you can see how important these stories are to the people who are telling you, the narrators. Mm-hmm. But you're also creating books. You're getting this out to the public. That's part of your mission. What's the impact on us? What's the effect of seeing this story about a woman that I don't know in this case? What effect do you think this has on us?
Well, the effect that I think about is this idea of thinking of how the stories we're living are creating who we are and creating the culture we're in. And that idea to understand how, as we listen to stories of others, those stories are becoming part of our own story and how we understand what it means to be human. Every single interaction we have is a struggle to make meaning. We've been sitting here for however many minutes, and you're trying to understand what it means to live through my body in this world and why I do it the way I do. I'm trying to understand you as well, why you're interested, why you're wanting to listen to these stories. And we're going to leave this place, both of us, with meanings about the world and what it means to be human we didn't have before this conversation. And as we listen to these stories, we can expand our understanding and we can change culture. If we're creating stories through these interactions and creating identity and creating culture, we can also dismantle meetings and dismantle toxic understandings that are impacting identities and lived experiences and have a transformed world.
I want to thank you for taking this hour to help transform us with your story and taking the time to talk with us. Thank you so much, Julianne.
Sure.
Julianne Scott Pollack is an associate professor in communication studies at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington, also the director of UNCW's Performance Studies. And that's the state of things for today, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.